Welcome back to the London Futurist podcast. Our guest in this episode is Francesca Rossi. Francesca studied computer science at the University of Pisa in Italy, where she became a professor before spending 20 years at the University of Padova. In 2015, she joined IBM's TJ Watson Research Lab in New York, where she is now an IBM Fellow and also IBM's AI Ethics Global Leader. Francesca is a member of numerous international bodies concerned with the beneficial use of AI, including being a board member at the Partnership on AI, a steering committee member and designated expert at the Global Partnership on AI, a member of the Scientific Advisory Board of the Future of Life Institute, and chair at the International Conference on Artificial Intelligence, Ethics and Society, which is being held in Montreal in August this year. From 2022 until 2024, she holds the prestigious role of the president of the AAAI, that is the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence. The AAAI has recently held its annual conference, and we'll be asking Francesca for her reflections on what happened there. Francesca, welcome to the London Futurist podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us, Francesca.
What else about your background and role might you like our listeners to know?
Something that you didn't mention because it's just 1 year, but I think it was very influential when I started my interest in AI ethics. And that was my sabbatical year at Harvard, at the Radcliffe Institute, which is a very multidisciplinary environment where every year there are 50 fellows from all over the world, but also from all the disciplines. So there are people covering all the sciences, all the humanities. And then the staff of this institute forces these people to spend time together, work together, understand each other. And this was very important for me because up to that point, that was 2014-15, up to that point I was just talking mostly to my fellow AI researchers. And then I learned that I needed to change the way I was saying things. I needed to open my perspective to be able to also collaborate with others. And that was really a very important shift for me because after that sabbatical year, I decided to join IBM with the idea of having a different impact, but also a different way of working with people also from other disciplines and not just AI researchers. And I think that's very important in AI ethics.
So it sounds like being obliged to talk to people outside your direct field and interact with them changed your life in a good way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Nowadays, there's a great deal of public interest in new AI systems that are built from large language models. They include things like stable diffusion and reinforcement learning, and they're generating lots of controversy, lots of excitement, lots of fear. And it seems that even longtime experts in AI have been a bit surprised at the capabilities of these new systems. Is that how you see things as well?
What really makes a difference is this ability for AI to generate content out of what has been trained of, whether those are images or text or other kinds of content. And this means that there are new issues or expanded issues compared to what non-generative AI already was raising in the field of AI ethics. Additional issues around privacy, copyright issues, and everything that comes from content moderation, which is not that easy with systems where the training data is not curated, is very large, and so it's more difficult to curate the training data. In a classical AI model or in a classifier or in a predictor, you try to curate the training data, for example, to mitigate bias, and then you curate also the way you build the model and so on. But here, it's really more difficult to do that, for example. And then there are also all those issues about content generation that have to do with the fact that these systems are built to optimize something which is not factuality, of course, but is the ability to write in a very, very syntactically good English or Italian or other languages, but not really to understand the difference between something that is true or false. That also brings about a lot of other issues in this content generation. Besides that, there is also the impact on jobs that we had already as an issue even before these new techniques came about. But this is really expanded in some sense and even more specialized in a different sense because, for example, there is an impact on creative jobs, an impact on some jobs that have to do with writing text or essays, and also an impact on education, because many students are using these tools to write essays. Especially in education, if people grow up in a way that they don't have the habit to reason and to make an effort even to collect different sources of information, put together an essay, then how are they going to behave and reason and live when they are adults? All sorts of different issues that imply that current AI ethics frameworks need to be adapted and expanded to cover them in the right way.
There are broadly two buckets of concerns about AI. There's short-term issues, which are sometimes called AI ethics. I prefer the term responsible AI. And that involves things like privacy, bias, transparency, copyright, systems which encourage people to get cross in order to keep their attention. That's a short-term set of issues. And then there's a longer-term set of issues, the other bucket, which is often called AI alignment or AI safety, which is making sure that very, very advanced AI systems, which we don't have yet, but making sure that they're safe to be around, to be on the same planet as. And Francesco, over the years, I've often thought that you think that my interest in superintelligence and my belief that it's quite likely to happen this century, I've often thought you think that's rather endearingly foolish. Maybe that's unfair. But what GPT has done, what ChatGPT has done for a lot of people is, although it's nowhere near superintelligence, and Blake Lemoine was wrong, it's not conscious, or the Google equivalent is not conscious, it is waking a lot of people up and making people think, wow, these things are getting incredibly smart. Either that or we are a lot less smart than we thought we were, and it's able to overtake us. And it's sort of showing a path by which these machines could become superintelligent eventually. Does that concern you, or am I right? And you think that the longer term issues, we don't need to worry about them because they're centuries away, and we just need to focus on the privacy, bias and transparency and so on.
My view about long term issues is that, not that they're foolish, definitely not, is that by addressing the short term issues as they evolve, and we have seen them evolving, we will be in a better position when the long-term issues, if and when they will come.
Do you think so, really?
Yeah. I'm not saying that there will never be long-term issues. There will probably be. But the way to address them, at least my way to address them, is to evolve in my understanding and my way of addressing short-term issues as they come about. I'm sure it's not your way of addressing them, but that's my way. And then about these large language models that you mentioned, there are two issues here. As you say, they're not more intelligent, whatever intelligent means, than other classical AI techniques. I don't know whether that's the right path to really achieve machines that have intelligence in the sense of being able, yes, to master language, but also to master logic, to master inference, to master reasoning, which to me doesn't appear that it's really there into these large language models. That's why in my research, I work in understanding how to combine classical AI techniques that focus on knowledge and reasoning and these data-intensive AI techniques. But it's true that, you know, many people say that, yes, we need to combine all the good things of these two kinds of AI, but it's not really clear at this point which one is the winning combination that can bring those two things. What comes from the use of data and what comes, it says, from the use of knowledge and reasoning. Definitely these large language models or foundation models more generally are going to be very useful even in the short term because of this idea, especially in the name foundation model, of being like a substrate that is trained over large amounts of data in an unsupervised way, and then further trained for each specific task in a supervised way with labeled data, which is more limited and less available and more costly to produce. That will shorten the time to build a specific application for a specific task, and also will allow to do that with less labeled data available for those tasks. That's going to bring a shift into many applications of AI. And also will allow to have this very expensive training phase for the large language model, but then very inexpensive use of the same trained large language model for each one of the specific application or specific tasks. That definitely will be a shift, but it needs to be handled with care. And we have seen many examples of why that is the case, because it's still not clear how to control the content or to put filters successfully in the content that is generated. So whether there is inappropriate content that is generated in these dialogues or privacy issues or incorrect responses, all those issues that is still not clear how to handle that. Some part of AI research thinks that those filters could be put by just human feedback reinforcement learning. But others think that maybe there is a way to really inject knowledge and reasoning into these large language models. The fact that millions of people can use them, and especially one of them, means that people that are expert in AI, but also everybody else, is getting to use and to see what these systems are capable of. Even experts like us, we really need to control ourselves to not anthropomorphize too much these AI systems, because we tend to say, oh, look what it is able to do, then it must be. But that inference that we do, often we do them because as human beings, we are used to make these inferences when we see something happening, some behavior from another human being. We know that we shouldn't do that, and we try not to do that. But I can imagine that somebody that is not used in controlling himself or herself, then it's very easy to see a chatbot that can write in such an eloquent way and really come up with very high-level responses to some questions or to follow a dialogue in a very similar to a human being.
A human-sounding way, yeah.
So do you agree that there are two kinds of mistakes that people can make as they try to make sense of these systems? One is the over-anthropomorphization that you've just mentioned, when people say, this shows some elements of human reasoning, therefore it's going to have other elements of human reasoning as well.
Yeah.
But there's also many people have been surprised by the fact that systems that they didn't think would have any abilities akin to human reasoning somehow seem to generate inside themselves, on the fly, their own internal deep learning networks, smaller ones that allow them to quickly acquire skills. Therefore, capabilities that were not expected, often these one-shot or quick training capabilities, have emerged unexpectedly.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, but again, we have also seen a lot of examples of inability to do reasoning and to do logical reasoning, which are very surprising.
Isn't this where your idea of thinking fast, thinking slow comes in? Your models, which you've adapted from some work with the Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman, who says that the human brain has got intuitive systems which are pretty fast, and then our rational systems are usually slower, and they operate in a marvelous or sometimes not so good interaction, and that the systems you imagine will have these deep learning models doing some of the work, heavy lifting of intuition, but there will also be reasoning systems there. And people are already proposing that the large language models can figure out by themselves, hey, this looks like a mathematical question, rather than try to brute force it by pattern recognition. It's time to waken up Wolfram Alpha and ask Wolfram Alpha for an answer. And here looks like a possible historical fact, rather than just try to imagine what might be a syntactically correct historical fact, we should search a certain historical database to validate it. So these combinations are coming along. I think this is the possibility to make things happen more quickly than skeptics will believe.
I understand that some capabilities that we see in the dialogues are surprising and they are emerging, but there are other surprising dialogues that show that even simple things that could be easily resolved by, as you say, looking up or using some data that I'm sure it's in the training data set, are instead not there. So there are still some mistakes, some incorrect inferences that surprisingly are made by a machine that has been trained on the whole of Wikipedia or the whole of many books and so on. So there are still something that is missing, and I'm not sure that necessarily adding more data and more computing power is the solution to those missing emergent behaviors. I understand that we see a lot of emergent behavior that are surprising on the reasoning side, but also on the lack of reasoning side. People in research are trying, you know, are making hypotheses. That's how research is done. You know, we're making hypotheses and then we see what happens and then we prove properties and we see emerging behaviors. It's good that the research community, and in particular, in this case, the AI research community, has many avenues that are followed by researchers to improve the capabilities of AI systems. And even that these various avenues are followed by researchers that build on top of each other. So there are the data-intensive research, and then the other, maybe less keen on data-intensive research, but then come about and they try to put additional capabilities there and so on. As you mentioned, even in this last AAAI conference, we have seen a lot of cross-fertilization between two areas of AI that maybe seemingly they seem to follow different paths, but they are more and more combined.
Do you think it's fair to say that the deep learning systems, which are about pattern recognition, massive amounts of data, that they are like the human fast-thinking intuitive system, whereas good old-fashioned AI, symbolic, logical AI, is more like the human slow-thinking system, the sort of logical thinking. Is that a reasonable analogy?
I don't know if they are fast-thinking systems because they rely on a lot of data that has been produced by slow systems. Like Wikipedia data has been produced by people or people with the help of technology reasoning about a problem and then defining it and then understanding and then solving it. So the data that these systems are trained on is also knowledge that comes from slow thinking processes.
But that's true of the human equivalent. If it is a reasonable analogy, because the human equivalent is you stare looking at the savannah for years and you're watching out for a leopard. And if you think there's a leopard, then you run like hell. You don't stop to think about it. You just run. You spend a great deal of time building up the pattern recognition ability to spot those stripes of the leopard. In the similar way, a deep learning system has ingested vast amounts of data to do its pattern recognition.
Yeah, but even human beings, even after having done these thinking slow activities that then translate into knowledge that then is used by the thinking fast system, there are still part of what we do where we devote really the reasoning capabilities, which is full attention and a lot of effort in solving problems. Maybe you are right. So those systems can be seen as thinking fast systems after an initial phase where the thinking slow of humans or other techniques have generated
after the training.
But the human beings keep on having the thinking slow capabilities and using it. And instead, if we move to the system like that, then it would be like somebody else has to do the thinking slow because they are not doing it.
What were the main themes of the recent annual conference of the Triple AI? You've mentioned various combinations, groups of people who previously didn't talk so much together are talking more now. Were there other themes that you would point to?
As I mentioned, one big theme was really to combine two or more sub-areas of AI. So one innovation in this Triple AI was this bridge program that was exactly about bridging two or more sub-areas of AI. And even AI and other disciplines outside AI, so to making these communities talk to each other and exchange and share ideas and results. There were invited talks about how to evaluate these new kind of AI systems, where the classical AI systems, you really were feeling that they were designed by us, so we could prove properties about the way we decided to design them. Here is more like a natural science approach. In fact, one of the invited talks, for example, was about the physics of AI. In the sense, like, take inspiration of what physics does to interpret a natural phenomena, to also understand what's going on in these large language models or foundation models. Even if we design them, but we design them in a way that then, once they are ready to be used, it's not easy for us to prove properties or to understand what to expect from their behavior because they have a lot of emergent behavior. And so maybe what in physics researchers have been doing to understand the natural phenomenon, some of the techniques can be adapted also here. But really, this bridge program was the main theme of the conference, to really have people talking to each other from different AI sub-disciplines, but also AI and other disciplines.
And what hope is there for interpretability? Because I think for both today's narrow AI and the future more general AI that we're coming to, interpretability, explainability, transparency are vital.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we will be misled. We will see something behaving in a certain way repeatedly and imagine that we understand it. But then when the wind changes, if there's a different number of days in the month or whatever, their behavior could be shockingly different and catch us all by surprise.
Right. Definitely explainability, interpretability, transparency, all these properties are very important. I see more and more the need to use AI systems in collaboration with human beings. And if a human being collaborates with another entity, whether it's a machine or another human being, you need to trust that entity. Otherwise, it would not be easy for you to really make decisions supported, for example, by knowledge or recommendation that come from this machine.
I'd like to just challenge you on that, Francisco. Personally, I think there's no chance we'll understand how a deep learning system works. They think in thousands of dimensions, and our brains simply can't do that. But we already rely heavily on things that we don't begin to understand. I don't understand how planes work. I've got a rough idea of the Bernoulli principle, but I understand that's only a little bit of how planes work. Every time I sit in an airplane and it takes off, I think, this is a miracle happening all around me. I don't know how it works, but I'm just going to go with it because I've gone with it several times before and it hasn't crashed. I assume it won't this time. We do it all the time. And I'm sure that's going to be the way we'll be with AI. We'll rely on it because it works.
But perhaps some people understand it.
Exactly.
You and I may not understand it, Callum.
Well, that's a fair point.
But there are enough people who understand why planes go up in the air and don't fall down.
It's a fair point up to a point. I understand that actually there are now believed to be quantum effects at the edges of wings that nobody understands. Certainly for a long time, we didn't understand how planes worked. People were flying all over the place and nobody knew how they worked. We've probably got a better handle on it now.
Yes, but we have to look at the broader ecosystem of AI, which is not just researchers doing research and then companies taking the results of this research and deploying tools and then people use it. There are also many other actors in this ecosystem, which are the policymakers, the standard organizations. All these other actors together, you have to look at the whole ecosystem, and that's what happens also with planes or with medicines or with others. So to understand that, yes, maybe I don't understand what I'm using at the level of detail, but these other pieces that the AI system need to comply with are giving me some assurance that what is happening at certain properties has passed some tests in order to make it acceptable for society to use. We have a lot of these pieces of the ecosystem that are working on, but they work at different speeds. But all of them need to be put in place. Standard associations, they are working on standards around various AI solutions or techniques. Many governments are thinking about how to harness the power of AI while not suppressing really innovation in their country. All this, I think, applies to planes, but also applies to AI. So now we are in a bit of an unsettled place because some of these pieces of the ecosystem move at different speed.
So tell me about this wide ecosystem, because sometimes people roll their eyes. Oh, there's yet another body here that seems to be discussing exactly the same thing. There's a partnership on AI and, oh, there's a global partnership on AI.
Very different things.
Do you justify all these bodies existing? Do you feel some are more successful than others?
A goal is the same, of course. But again, the ecosystem has very different entities. The partnership on AI as partners, companies, universities, civil society organizations. So these are the partners that get together to understand some issues and give guidelines, recommendations, information, knowledge, and so on. The global partnership on AI, instead, is very different because the partners are governments. And the governments from all over the world, like 30 or something. The idea is that the goal is the same, how to get the best out of this technology and avoid the risks to people, to the planet, and so on. But one is trying to understand how companies, together with civil society organizations and academia, can understand the best practices. And the other one, the global partnership on AI, is to understand through the experts that these governments nominate and they work together in various working groups, to understand how governments can facilitate, can play their part in facilitating a responsible definition and deployment and use of the technology.
I've read that China was a member of the global partnership on AI, so the government version of those two bodies you talked about, and is no longer a member. Is that right?
I don't think it was ever a member. I don't remember it was ever a member.
Would you like it to be a member?
I think there is a value in trying to define things when there is more alignment of values.
A coalition of the willing.
Governments that think alike. This is something that is used for the global partnership of AI. Which is obviously not completely true, because there are many different governments in the global partnership on AI that are not necessarily completely aligned, but they share some values. There is a value in being based on this alignment to initially define the best practices and so on. But there is also a value, of course, and this is done in other organizations as well, in talking and discussing and collaborating with people that really think differently. That's what I learned when I was at this Radcliffe Institute. Those people were not even understanding me at first. And so there is a value and there is a learning that we can do for ourselves, for our societies, also in speaking with people that think very differently from us.
The other question about these international bodies, and I'm asking you, because you live in two worlds. You live in the world of AI, but you're also deeply immersed in all these international bodies, is can they keep up with the pace of change in AI? Because the perception is that politicians and human bodies are too slow to adapt, and they'll be discussing yesterday's problems and unable to consider tomorrow's problems.
Yeah. As I said, different actors in this ecosystem, they have different speeds. And especially the policymakers, For example, I'm thinking about the European AI Act that is under discussion right now. They also try to make it, they call it future-proof. But of course, it's very difficult to make a law future-proof with the technology that is so rapidly evolving and in so maybe unexpected ways, of months after months or even week after week. It's not an easy task because they understand that they work at a slower pace than the technology. That's why they work a lot with the people experts in the technology to understand better how they could make it future-proof. Also to allow for this regulation, when it will be approved, to allow for fast changes in some parts of the regulation, and they have their own ways of doing that, like the addendum or the appendix and so on.
I suppose you work with people on the Global Partnership on AI who have made themselves genuinely experts in how AI works and what its implications are. I suppose the interesting question is, do those people, when they're back talking to their more senior colleagues in their home governments, do they have any purchase? Does anybody listen to them? Because certainly the impression I have of British politicians, being, you know, the country I know best, is they have no clue, most of them. Certainly the most senior ones have no clue how AI works. They have no clue about the possible implications. They can probably string together a few sentences about it, which wouldn't be completely daft because they're consummate communicators. But really, they're not thinking about it. They're not taking it seriously, and they don't understand it.
Well, the Global Partnership on AI also has the role of connecting more tightly people in government and in the various ministries and the experts in AI. That, I think, is already a good goal because, as you said, these people, they have a different job, and in their job, they need to be able to listen to knowledge that comes from the experts. Even at AAAI, we have currently policy committees that try to inform policymakers with knowledge from AI and the real capabilities, limitations, and risks of AI, coming from people that are experts in AI. That's a very important goal that AI experts should work on, besides advancing AI. Another thing that I was thinking related to the previous question about engaging with everybody in the world, not just a few parts of the world that are more aligned, is that at the AAAI conference, for example, a large percentage of papers come from US, Europe, but also a very large percentage from China and Asia. AAAI is just one of them, but these are conferences that are really putting together all these different kinds of people that come from different cultures, different legal systems, so different priorities given to values. That's also a good place where these different communities come together and share their view of AI, because by doing research, you also share your own view of the technology.
A final question. Since we are futurists, we want to ask about the future. What do you think your own focus will be in 3 or 5 years' time? Will you be having the same conversation still, or will you be doing something different?
Well, I'm moving towards more human AI collaboration and co-creation research, where these machines that hopefully can have their own capabilities of thinking fast and slow, inspired by how humans do these two broad modalities of decision making. I hope that these machines built in that way can have a better chance of collaborating and co-creating with humans, and even understanding that humans use their own thinking fast and slow in making decisions. So to exploit these two modalities in both the machines and the human being to achieve a better co-creation and collaboration. The overall goal, in my view, is really to help human beings progress, be more aware, evolve. And I hope that machines can help in that respect too. So my goal is mostly on humans rather than the machines.
Helping humans to live with AIs, to work alongside AIs, where appropriate, to configure and design them. And part of that involves changes in how we are designing the AIs themselves so that they are more human compatible. I wish you great success in that project. I do want to have a happy relationship with the AIs in the future rather than being deeply frustrated or even cursing them. Thanks so much, Francesca Rossi, for joining us today on London Futurist Podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you, Francesca.
Thanks, Carlo.